he had planned the launch was going to be on a Wednesday or Thursday night or something like that. And he's like, brilliant, I'll get 10 kegs in from you. I'll probably need a few of them for the launch, and that'll do me then for 2 weeks, and I'll get beer off you the next time. So we dropped 10 kegs into them. The beer was gone by 10:30.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, I'm joined by Gráinne Walsh, the founder of Metal Man Brewery in County Waterford, as one of the best business names I've ever heard. Gráinne went from a career in tech to becoming a brewery owner. We touch how the hell that happened, her journey from working at Amazon to founding and running her own brewery down in Waterford, and what that has meant for her in the last 10 years. Gráinne was doing breweries before they were even cool. That's how early Gráinne was, the brewing party. So we chat about how she started, why she got into it, how she transitioned from tech to brewing, and what that's meant for the last 10 years and her journey. She teaches me a lot about the brewing business because I knew absolutely nothing. It's a really interesting chat. Here's my chat with Gráinne Walsh, the founder of Metal Man Brewing in County Waterford. Gráinne, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Delighted to be here.
It's great.
And we're having 2 hours off work in the afternoon.
Yeah, I'll pencil the whole afternoon off. Treat yourself.
Absolutely.
We're doing it via Zoom, obviously. We can't still meet up. We're in the middle of another lockdown. So just give people a quick intro as to who you are.
Sure. My name is Gráinne Walsh. I am one of the founders of Metal Man Brewing Company. We're a microbrewery based down in Waterford City. We have been knocking around for 9.5 years now at this stage. Our 10th birthday will be early next year, assuming we all make it that far with COVID-19 in circulation. And I had previously worked in the tech industry before I decided that I wanted to do something completely different and quit my job in January 2011. And here I am.
2011. An interesting time to quit. We'll come back on that. 9.5 years. You were doing it before it was cool.
yes. Yes, if it, indeed it is still cool, I don't know, but I know it is. It's good crack. It's a really fun industry to be in. It's challenging, but it is fun. It's green tea I'm drinking, just in case you think I'm on the sauce at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, we could have just hidden it. We could have just said, oh, it's late. This is a fake ring light I got. How did you get into brewing? How did you get into brewing? What was the leap? Because give people a bit of an insight into what you were doing before, because it's not exactly sure. Going, oh, I was doing this, and then I just, the logical progression was into brewing.
Well, I suppose I probably have myself convinced over the last decade that it was a completely rational and normal leap to make. I've always really enjoyed beer. I think it's a really fun drink. It's a nice social thing to enjoy with your friends. When I started drinking beer initially, I drank the same industrial beer that most people sort of drink maybe when they're in college or whatever. But my other half is English. And when we met initially, I was still living in Dublin and he was living in the UK. And we would travel over and back to meet each other. And he would come to Ireland and say, oh my God, the stout is amazing over here. And I would go visit him in the UK and say, well, what are all these weird beers? I don't know what any of them are. So he would say, I've had this one before, try this one, it's good. And it tasted like nothing I'd ever had before because I was used to lager. Mm. So that sort of helped me appreciate beer on a very different level. And really, it was just kind of a slippery slope after that. It wasn't long before the holidays revolved around breweries and the home brew started to be attempted. And we were starting to get quite proficient at that. And because it was actually back in sort of the mid-noughties, it was quite hard to get a decent beer in Ireland if you didn't live within a stone's throw of somewhere like the Porterhouse.
Yeah.
There were very few places like the Porterhouse. Mm. It was really only just the Porterhouse, to be honest. So it was becoming increasingly more talked about, but still not available. And even getting homebrew ingredients was challenging enough. But as it was, I was working in IT at the time. I started working for Amazon in 2007. And they would periodically send me off to Seattle to work with different teams over there. And I was just in beer heaven over there. Mm. The West Coast of the States had an amazingly vibrant beer scene, it still does. And I could not believe that you could just pretty much walk into any bar and have your choice of amazing locally brewed beers. without needing to drag the people you were with off to some obscure bar in the middle of nowhere that they didn't want to go to try a particular beer from someone. You could just walk in somewhere and say, there are 11 or 12 beers on draft here that I've never had before, and they sound amazing. I better try them all. it was a revelation to me that beer could be so accessible, that good beer could be so accessible. And I suppose really around the same time, I was kind of starting to feel like IT was not an industry I wanted to be in longer term. I felt like a bit of an imposter, really. While I enjoyed what I was doing and the people that I worked with and the work that was going on in the company that I was involved in, I never really felt as passionate or excited about it the way a lot of my colleagues seemed to be.
The key word there.
I really felt like a lot of the people I worked with were really excited about what it was we were doing. They were really interested in it. They were very deep in terms of their knowledge. And, you know, it was the kind of stuff that they wanted. You know, they wanted to talk about it all the time because it was that interesting to them. Whereas I was like, guys, it's lunchtime. Can we talk about something else? Okay. Or, you know, we're out in the pub in the evening. It's IPA time, not API time.
Yeah. Nice.
It was... But so I suppose I felt like a little bit, I felt like it was inevitable that I needed to remove myself really from that side of things, because I wanted to be working on something as passionately as the people that I worked with in Amazon were passionate about what they were working on. But I knew that I wasn't going to find that in the tech industry.
That's interesting that you could see that passion, but you knew you wouldn't be able to tap into that yourself for IT. Was IT your background? Was that something through your whole career was IT?
Yeah, I kind of fell into it, really. I did apply maths and computing in Limerick. And then I ended up in IBM just sort of kind of as part of the mill grounds that used to happen back in the good old days. Mm. And
did you co-op?
Then, yeah.
Co-op out of UL or LIT?
I did co-op with ESB International on Baggot Street there. I went to do maths and computers in Limerick because I really like maths and I didn't really know what else I wanted to do with myself. And then it just sort of kind of went from there. I never really sat down and thought about what I wanted to do after college or where I wanted to go or what direction I wanted to go in. And I ended up in network engineering for a while, which I really enjoyed and I really found fun. And that's where I suppose I started to focus in on it in when I thought about tech more, I suppose, as a career. I was maybe 2 to 3 years out of college at that stage. And network engineering was something I really enjoyed. It was the problem solving and troubleshooting aspect of it. So I sort of went down that route. But again, I was a bit flighty now, if I were to be honest with it. I packed in the job and went off in a camper van in 2001. And I came back and did a bit of project management.
Where did you go in the camper van? You can't just gloss over that and then move on. You can't just say something that interesting and then just move on.
Well, once again, beer is involved. We sort of knew that we wanted to just get away for a bit, or at least I knew I wanted to get away for a bit, and I told the other fella he was coming with me. And we bought the van, and we decided we would set off in September 2001.
From here?
From Ireland, yeah. And our destination was Oktoberfest in Munich. And then after that, we didn't know.
Okay.
So that was kind of the only deadline. And so we booked a ferry, and we tried to make sure the van was mechanically sound before the ferry date. That didn't really work out so well. It was mechanically present, but I'm not sure if sound was would be the right word to describe it. And we only broke down once on the way to the ferry, though.
On the way to the ferry. All right.
We only made that ferry by the skin of our teeth. So we set off with our trusty Volkswagen across to Munich, and then after that we didn't really know. So we ended up in Italy. We actually stayed in Verona for 4 months and we learned Italian there.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did you know how long you were going for?
No.
Love it.
Just sort of set off.
And how did the camper van life? Did that suit you? Did you enjoy it?
Loved it. Loved it so much that I came back to the real world and worked for about 18 months. And then it was like, nah, let's go again.
Really?
And we went off to the Alps then for 6 months. So we worked as walking guides up in the Dolomiti, northern Italy.
Incredible.
And yeah, that was fun. That was a really fun summer. And then we went to, we had been working at AT&T and we went then to work for AT&T again on a contract in Slovakia. They had just opened a big center over there. There was a lot of really, really talented engineering young people over in Slovakia. So we got to work with some really, really cool people over there. We did that until, I think, summer 2005. We came back to Ireland then.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'm not... The transition to brewing is not such a shock now after that kind of intro. I'm kind of, it kind of does seem like a logical progression. So you came back 2005 and then did another 4 or 5 years in the real world.
I started back in work in Dublin in 2006, January 2006, and then I went to work for Amazon the following year. And I spent 3.5 years, I think, at Amazon, which possibly had been the longest job I'd ever had.
Okay.
Until Metalman, which is by far and away the longest job I've ever had.
Yeah. So. But that Amazon at the time probably would have been the hot gig in town, were they? Were they were just coming in and there would have been a big...
I think, if I remember correctly, there were 51 people working in Amazon when I joined.
Okay.
Yeah, we were in the digital hub in a tiny little office. Not tiny, but there was me and... initially, one other woman and a bunch of men.
Wow. 49
those
men.
Those are the times. Those are the times. Not everybody was based in that site because we had people in the data centers as well.
Okay.
But then, yeah, by the time I left, then 3 and a bit years later, there were like 200 people. And I think now there's like, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000?
Yeah, you would imagine thousands.
A lot.
You saw a lot, I'd say, in those 3 years.
EC2 and S3 were the hot new things that people were talking about that were like, what's this S3 thing that people keep talking about down in, and was it, I'm not sure whether that one was Seattle or Cape Town or, but I can't quite remember, but it was brand new at that time. We didn't really have any, there were no AWS staff in Dublin because AWS wasn't even really a thing.
Almost. Really?
It was so new.
So what?
Growing pretty rapidly.
Yeah, when you look back now at where they've come, like, was that something you kind of see? Okay, this company are on a huge trajectory upwards, or were you kind of surprised even by the growth?
I'm not sure I would have given it enough thought, if I'm honest. Amazon was, even though the Irish operation was small, it was a pretty big machine, and we were small fry compared to everything, you know, the rest of. Basically what was going on in North America for the most part. So I suppose it doesn't really surprise me. I didn't sit around thinking this company is going to keep growing into this behemoth that we see today, but possibly just because I assumed it would.
I think sometimes when you're inside things like that, it's hard to see externally. It's hard to kind of step out. But how did you, 2011, you said you left. Interesting time to decide to...
That was fun. I remember driving down I left the Amazon car park with everything packed in the back of my little black Corolla hatchback, driving down the M9 going, what am I doing?
Talk me through the process. How did you even come up with, okay, I'm going to leave, first decision, second decision, I'm going to leave and start a brewery?
I suppose the decision came a different way, maybe. Probably since, if I'm honest, since about 2004, I was like, I need to find a different, I probably need to get out of the IT industry and do something that's a bit more creative. I need to feel like I'm doing something that makes me feel, I suppose that gives me a sense of inner satisfaction. I probably wouldn't have been able to put it into those words at that time. I just knew I needed a change. So that's why I say I was flighty. What I was doing, instead of really trying to pivot my my career or my working life. What I did was I just buggered off in a camper van. And that was enough at the time. And then I was like, okay, better earn some money and get back into the real world again each time, but without changing. It was just easy then to go, you know, I'd had a bit of a break, I'd had a reset, and it was easy to just default back into what I had been doing before that. But I was fixing the wrong thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So when I got into Amazon and I was like, you know, I had always told myself I had perfectly good reasons to quit the other jobs that I had quit in the past. You know, I didn't like the people, or I didn't like the work, or I didn't like the politics or the office culture, or, you know, I had a string of reasons. It was never me. It was always the things that I'm, you know, that are being inflicted on me that are the problem. Whereas then I found myself in a situation working for a company that, you know, it was really fun to work for. The people were really cool. They were really, really smart. The work was really, really interesting. But I was still like, this is not for me. So I kind of had to really accept at that stage that the problem wasn't going to be fixed by, you know, rinse and repeat. The thing that needed to change was me. So I had been sort of, you know, I had dabbled with the idea of different things, I suppose, in my head over the couple of years, and, you know, teaching English as a foreign language, maybe just travel or, you know, yoga or just kind of sort of esoteric stuff like that, maybe. But I hadn't really come up with anything that spoke to me, or that I felt would be, that wasn't just me running away, I suppose, rather than something I was running towards. And then the, you know, we were, then we started brewing beer at home and started brewing a well. And I met a couple of people that were probably instrumental on helping me understand what brewing as a career looked like, or brewing as a business, I suppose, looked like. And I suppose notably there, there's a brewery in Lincolnshire in the UK called Brewster's, and they're over in Grantham. And we ended up in that part of England randomly at one point, and we reached out to them and said, hey, we're beer fans and we're going to be in the area. Do you do tours of your brewery? And yada, yada, yada. This is what we do. People who are a little bit obsessive about beers, we just we turn up at other people's breweries, usually on, hopefully not unannounced, but sometimes unannounced. But the guys behind Brewster's emailed us back pretty much straight away and said, yeah, we'd love to talk to you. We had actually looked at setting up in Ireland before we set up in England. Come on in on Saturday morning, we'll show you around.
Brilliant.
And they were brilliant. And we kind of told them, you know, we were like, oh, we've been starting to brew beer and we're kind of thinking we might, you know, like to know more about brewing as a business, because I'm, you know, I need a bit of change and thinking this might be it, but we don't know anything about it. And they were like, just the thing for you. Come back to us in the summer and we'll put you to work for a week.
Oh,
and you can dispel any glamorous notions that you think you might have.
What a great way, though.
Working in a brewery.
Yeah. What a class way of learning. Like, that's the only way, really.
It was amazing. So that summer, that was 2010. Yeah, that was 2010. The day I handed in my thesis for my master's in theoretical physics, because that was another thing I thought I might do when I was trying to escape from...
Theoretical physics seems like the logical escape.
I thought maybe I might go back to academia, so I decided to do a master's. And I quickly realised that that was not going to happen, so I finished it off and said, that's that done. So the day I handed in that thesis, we got on a ferry and we drove across to Grantham. It was the hottest week on record at that stage, by about 10 years.
In the camper you drove over?
And we went, no, we weren't in the camper, we were just in the car. And we went and we worked. And a brewery, the reason I mentioned the temperature is that a brewery is not a very nice environment in either extremes of temperature.
Okay.
So when it's hot outside, it's really, really hot and sweaty in a brewery. And when it's cold outside, it's really, really cold.
Right, okay.
Typically, this is what happens. So we were put to work. We had our wellies on. We were digging out mash tuns, monitoring brews, prepping grain. They also took us through the business side of it and, you know, helped us understand what the important things are to look at and stuff like that. So, and it was just a phenomenal learning experience. Absolutely brilliant.
But what an open, I love entrepreneurs like that. They're clearly the ones that are comfortable in their own skin. They know they're not afraid of competition or other people. Oh. I think that's brilliant. Like there's definitely not enough opportunities like that for people who are aspiring to be entrepreneurs to actually go and be a little apprentice for like a week or a month or whatever.
It was absolutely fantastic. So
it didn't deter you anyway.
No, far from it. We were like buzzing. Coming back.
You knew.
So we were like, you know, is there any reason we shouldn't give this a shot? You know, I think it's time to pull together the business plan, look realistically at what we want to do and figure out how we're going to do it. So I would say maybe 3 months later, I handed in my notice and I had by that stage arranged for a brewery in Tipperary called White Gypsy to brew our first batch of beer.
Okay, you didn't hang around.
Figured out. No. That is one of my driving character traits, which can be a curse and a blessing.
I was interested to see what word you're going to use there. Were you going to use flaw or trait?
Flaw. It is both. So we had decided that Tim would stay. He was working in Microsoft at the time, so he was going to stay put and keep the ship afloat, so to speak. And I was going to
have all the fun
off and see what happened. Mm. Yeah. So that was that autumn, that October, I think I handed in my notice to finish at the end of January. That was a long 3 months, actually. I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. I thought I was doing the right thing by my employer, giving them a lot of notice, but it was too long.
As in you found it hard to put the time down?
I found it hard to stay motivated and engaged.
Okay.
Over that period of time then for the remaining 3 months that I was there, because I knew, particularly with Christmas in the middle of it, that it was going to be, I just wasn't feeling it.
You were gone. You're already brewing the beer in your head. So how does that work then? You got someone else to brew the first batch for you. So how does that work? Can you go to them with an idea or a recipe, or how does that work?
Yeah, so Coolon Lochnan, who runs White Gypsy down in Templemore, he is like a massive supporter of the Irish craft beer industry and always has been. He learned brew in Canada and he came back and was working in Mestres McGuire's, which is now JW Sweetenham.
On the keys there. Yeah.
And then he set up his own place. So I'd known Coolon for a couple of years at that stage. And I had approached him about it and he was like, sure. And he also, as well as Sean and Sarah over in the UK, Coolon was also indispensable in terms of the amount of advice he was able to give us. Some of it very well received, some of it not so well received.
Don't do it.
You don't want to know that. Pretty much. you have to pick and choose sometimes what you're prepared to take on board.
Yeah, blissful ignorance works sometimes in the early stages. Yeah. You just ignore. Yeah.
Blind optimism and blissful ignorance.
So he brewed your first batch then for you?
We brewed for almost a year at Coolon site.
Okay.
We went to Coolon with the recipe for our pale ale, which was kind of the first American style pale ale that was going to be released on the Irish market, brewed in Ireland. So we had, I suppose we were taking inspiration from those West Coast beers that I was so fond of doing quality assurance on when I would go to Seattle. But we brought the ABV down. A lot of American pale ales tended to be a bit stronger than we thought the rest of the beers on the bar in Ireland were all kind of hovering around the 4.3%. And we were worried that if we came out with a 5.5% or that we would probably do the image of craft beer more harm than good.
I get you.
By sort of having this much stronger beer out there that was kind of, we were trying to go neck and neck with the beers that were already on the bar as a kind of a reasonable competitor. And what we didn't want was people saying, oh, you know, I really like that craft beer, but it'll blow the head off you. You can't drink more than 12. I don't know.
Standard Irish style, that's exactly what would be said.
So I'll stick to the industrial lager that I always drink. We didn't want that. So we said, well, look, if we make it the same ABV as the rest of them, then that removes that that comparison straight away, that it can't be, you know, if they're not choosing it for the alcohol strength or not, as the case may be. So we went to go along with our recipe. He was brewing more kind of red and dark red beers and stouts at that point, and lagers. So he was kind of like, okay, there's a lot of hops in this beer. Are you sure that'll work? We were like, yes. Yeah. So that was kind of nerve-wracking, because here you have like a seasoned professional saying, I'm not sure about this beer recipe.
Okay.
You know, are you sure? And I just had to go, yep.
Well, you don't know what you don't know, as they say when you're starting off.
Well, that's it. And he's like, well, fine, it's your beer, it's your problem. If I can't sell it.
As long as you pay the invoice, I'll cook it up whatever way he wants.
That's exactly it.
It must have been a bit of a chance as well, a bit of a risk back then. So it's only when you're explaining it, I'm thinking back to like back home in Tip, especially, like, you know, you'd have the five on draft. And then if you were fancy, you'd look down the fridge, you'd have the same five in bottle. If you were having notions about yourself drinking a bottle, you know, when Corona arrived, it was like the new world was here. So funny. And that's not that. If you're real fancy, if you went to college and came back with notions, you got Corona. But it's funny. Like, I remember, one night got a Heineken tap in, and it was the height of the talk of the town for about 2 weeks. So yeah, it's not that long ago actually, when you talk about craft beer and stuff coming in. So how did you get people on board in terms of like, what was your, okay, so brewing it, that's fine. But then how did you get people to stock it and sell it?
Well, we started at a time when there was very little Irish beer on the market, very little authentically Irish beer on the market. And people were starting to be interested in it. So the economy wasn't doing all that well. Unemployment was still kind of high, and we were, it seems ridiculous almost to say it at the moment, given what we're facing right now, but people were careful about where they spent their money. And here we were, coming along with this beer. But in some ways, we wonder if that almost helped us, because as people got more and more interested in local and supporting what was going on around them rather than imported and, you know, faceless sort of brands, we felt that maybe they were actually a little bit more interested in spending a little bit more on a beer, but having maybe one less. So maybe drinking four beers instead of five beers, but having four that they really enjoyed. So there seemed to be a bit of that going on. But equally, when we started, because there was so little Irish beer on the market and it was starting to gain a little bit of momentum, we had no problem really selling our small batches from coming out of Templemore pretty quickly. And it wasn't long before we had a rolling production schedule down there, because we had been living in Dublin, and there were a good bunch of bars that we used to go to that specialized in beer.
Okay.
And we had gone to them initially to say, you know, we're thinking about doing this. Do you think you might stock it? And they were like, yeah, deadly. And there is a guy called Jeff Carty. He runs 57 The Headline now, down on Clanbrassil Street there. Always a brilliant supporter of Irish craft beer. Jeff was working in the Bull and Castle there in Dublin too at the time. And we would have been regulars of Jeff's.
They used to do a beer hall upstairs, did they? Or am I imagining that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, beer hall upstairs. And that is where we had our launch on, I think it was the 3rd of March, 2011. And I remember going to Jeff, and he was, I think if I have the numbers right now, I went to him and said, so the launch, we had planned the launch was going to be on a Wednesday or Thursday night or something like that. And he's like, brilliant. I'll get 10 kegs in from you. I'll probably need a few of them for the launch, and then that'll do me then for 2 weeks, and I'll get beer off you the next time you're in town. So I said, grand. So we dropped 10 kegs into them. The beer was gone by 10:30.
Wow. Right. Ireland.
So we were just like, now what do we do? So it's like on the phone to Coolon going, we're going to need another batch of beer. But
had you brewed up much? Had you like, I don't know how much a brew in beer would be like. How much did you brew in the first time?
I'm trying to remember now what batch. I think it was 30 kegs at a time out of Coolon's brewery. And that was, you know, we were just flabbergasted that this had happened. And
that was one pub as well.
And that was one pub, and that was like a third of the stock that we had, and we weren't due to have any more for however long. So
this brewing business is simple.
Yeah, we were like, easy. So yeah, I mean, from there then, what really we had done is everything that we really loved about being beer fans suddenly became things that we were doing for a living. So we were, you know, we were going to beer festivals, and we were meeting loads of people, and we were getting to try loads of different beers and talk to other people in the industry. And we were in and out of the brewery, delivering to pubs, catching up with people we knew in the pubs where they were working and stuff like that. And it was a mental couple of years, those first.
So you were doing everything, doing everything from coming up with the ideas to the branding, the marketing, and then the door-to-door, hand-to-hand combat of selling it in.
While also getting ready to build out the brewery in Waterford. So initially we had only anticipated brewing up in Templemore for maybe 6 months, but the site where we were initially planning to locate the brewery fell through. So in the summer of 2011, so we had to go back to the drawing board and look at new buildings to lease, and then getting the brewery fit out done and the excise bond sorted, yada, yada, yada. So it was April 2012 before we started brewing ourselves down in Waterford, which was actually just over a year that we were brewing in Coulon then. I think we did our last batches of beer in Coulons in March. So it was maybe 13 months that we were brewing in Tipperary. But so as well as doing all of the shifting around and delivering out of the back of the trusty old Ducato, and I had one guy start to work in brewery in the summer of 2011. But aside from that, and trying to sign leases and start fit outs, and we had bought a secondhand brewery already and it was in storage, so we were waiting to get that moved down as well.
That was going to be my next question, like, how the hell do you build a brewery? You said it so matter of fact. All right, we started building the brewery. Where do you even start with something like that? You obviously bought a second-hand brewery, or how does
that work? A second-hand kit that came out of a brewery in the west of Ireland. So it had been in Clare, in a little village called Ina on the way to Lynch. Mm-hmm. And it had been Biddy Early's Brewery was the name the Baron Brewery. And that had kind of been set up as one of the first waves of microbrewing Ireland, that the around the time the Porterhouse set up, there were a bunch of small breweries that set up around then as well. And Biddy Early's was one of them. And they closed down in, I'm going to say about 2008 or 9, I'm not quite sure, I'd have to check with Neil. But their brewery had gone into storage, and Coulon had links with them.
Okay.
And we knew that that was for sale, and he put us in touch with Neil, and we organized getting all that done. So we kind of, that was the thing, I suppose, that helped us precipitate the beginning. Mm. It was like, okay, look, there's secondhand plant, they're ready to go. If we're going to do this, this is an opportunity to, you know, buy everything that we need, or 90% of what we need in one go, and then start it from there. Because otherwise, like you say, we were exactly in the same boat. How do you build a brewery? Where do you start?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, how do you build a house? Well, it depends what kind of house you want.
Yeah, there's no simple question, I'd imagine.
And how much of the work you're going to do yourself. So, you know, there's a lot of variables, and it'll all come down to decisions that you make along the way, for good or bad. But there is no, like, you could crucify yourself with researching all the different options, but then you never get started. So you just have to draw a line in the sand and say, right, that's it, we're going.
Yeah, it's like anything, isn't it? You can always, like, it's like even when you're buying something small, you can look at 1,000 reviews and then go, oh, I could get the other one. It doesn't really matter. It's
25 euro. Just buy it.
Exactly. Exactly. So you bought the brewery, brought it down. What's the bond thing you talk about?
So as a producer of alcohol, we are liable for the excise duty, which is basically the alcohol tax on all of the beer that we produce.
Okay.
If we want to produce alcohol in Ireland, you have to tell the revenue commissioners about it, and they will appoint an excise officer for you to deal with, who will make sure basically that you're not snaffling money out of the revenue coffers by selling bootleg liquor. So what has to happen is all of the alcohol that gets produced must be accounted for. And it gets stored what we call under bond. So what that means is we don't pay any alcohol tax on all of the beer we produce until it leaves our warehouse.
Gotcha.
And that means that everything is stored in our bonded warehouse. And that's a for cash flow purposes, that is incredible. Like it would be very difficult otherwise to manage what we do without having a bond to operate under. And that was one of the things that was quite challenging when we started out, because most of the bonded warehouses in this country are, as I understand it, for wholesalers of spirits, tobacco, that sort of thing. And it's very straightforward. You buy things in, you sell them on. They come in under bond. They're already packaged and in whatever format. And then you sell them again under bond, or you sell them once they leave your warehouse, then you pay the excise tax on them. The alcohol producers in Ireland at the time were mostly enormous. So there were a handful of production warehouses that the revenue needed to deal with, and they were all operating on a massive scale. Right. So these are huge, huge operations where there's probably a full-time revenue person working with them, because they're making hundreds of thousands of litres a day. And, you know, it's quite a complex operation. And then there were like the handful of microbreweries that were set up around the time that we set up as well. And, you know, I think Dungarvan Brewing set up a year before us. So we were lucky that the excise officer that we were appointed had already gone through all this with Dungarvan. But that meant that Dungarvan had to go through the initial pain of somebody working for revenue going, a microbrewery, what's that? We don't even have a rule book for it. So it was just, it was writing the rule book as they went along. And it was pretty painful. And, you know, a lot of the microbrewers in Ireland, we operate under very small bonds. You know, they're 10, 20, 30 grand. It's not a lot of, you basically, the bond is your commitment to the government that if all of your beer gets stolen out of the tanks and kegs and packaging that's already in your warehouse, that you will pay the government the money that you owe.
Okay.
Subject to that bond. But but when they don't have a rule book and you're dealing with a government department, that sort of, they're not going to like, necessarily stick their neck out and say, well, look, this seems like the practical way to do it. Will we just go ahead and do it like this? You know, every I must be dotted, every T must be crossed, and things must be signed off, and there has to be a lot of paperwork in place to make sure everything gets done according to the book. The problem is the book is about 200 years old, and the alcohol laws in Ireland are very antiquated. So the terms of our bond are you know, refer to quarts and gallons.
Oh,
and
wow,
things.
Still.
Yeah.
Even though
with
the rise of so many breweries and micro distilleries and all that, they're still old-fashioned.
Now, it may have changed since. It isn't something that I delve into for the fun of it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I don't think I ever want to do it again. But yeah, it's 48 reputed quart bottles, I believe, is what our minimum sale, wholesale amount is.
So what happened then when you got, after that first year, you were selling through enough from Coulon's Brewery and then got your own.
What was
that feeling like? What was that feeling of having, like, look, walking into this building, kind of looking at the tanks and going, all right, okay, what do we do now?
Well, the initial feeling of this brewing stuff must be easy. Oh dear, we better throw this first batch of beer away because it doesn't taste very good. That's kind of what happens when you start brewing yourself. No, it's a, you know, it's a huge learning curve, but obviously, as I said, we learned an awful lot from Coulon. He was extremely generous with his knowledge, and he was always on the end of the phone. He came down and he helped me with my refrigeration system. He came down for another day as well to help me do something. He was, you know, he was so genuine and helpful. And you just, there's an element of just getting stuck in and making mistakes and understanding what those mistakes are and then not making them again. You just sort of have to figure it out as you go along. And that's kind of life, really, isn't it?
Well, I think it's just that not being afraid to make them as well, not being afraid to just, been so terrified by it that you don't do anything. You just wait.
Yeah.
I think it also, your story also illustrates the importance of making good connections and just being afraid, not being afraid to ask as well, not being afraid
very,
to just,
very much so. Yeah.
You know, because if you always.
And then you got to pay that back so that when people do ring you up and say, I'm thinking of setting up a brewery, and you can be like, oh my God, my week is so busy this week. But you're like, okay, I can't see you this week, but what about next week?
Yeah.
Here's a whole lot of questions in the meantime.
Here's the FAQ.
and then come and if you have the answer, once you have the answers to all these, ring me back and we'll set something up and you can come down and have a look.
You must have seen a huge explosion since you guys started, just to go off on a little tangent there for a second.
And I met loads of people who wanted to open microbreweries, and I tried as hard as I could to make time to see them all, but there were, I would say in 2014, 2015, we were so busy because we were starting to roll out upgrades in the brewery at that stage. It just got to a point where I was like, look, I haven't got time and I can't see you. But we did try and see everyone, and we tried to make sure people knew, a bit like Coulon tried to do with us. We tried to make sure people knew what they were going to be getting into. Mm. But without saying, God, don't do it.
Yeah, I suppose it's a fine line, isn't it? I'm sure it kind of was very in vogue. Was at one stage, is there a micro distillery or brewery in every county in Ireland? Was that a stat I read recently?
I'm sure there probably is at this stage. There are some places that have multiple, and then there were a few, I think, there might have been a bit of a drought in the Midlands or up around Leitrim, maybe. I'm not quite sure. But there was a big beer festival that used to be held in the RDS, that the first year of it was 2011. And it was spearheaded by an events organizer called Bruce and Seamus from O'Hara's Brewing Company. And they came together to organize this big event. And the very first year of it, September 2011, we were like one of 11 breweries at that event, and we were in the industry hall in the RDS, and the lads were like, bring whatever furniture you have to meet.
Pad it out a bit.
bring stools and tables if you had them. We want to fill up the space a bit. It's a big, big hall. And then by the time we did that event for the last time, which I think was 2018, maybe, it was 2017, 2018, it was like standing room only, obviously, no furniture, extra furniture allowed. There were, I don't know, maybe 100.
Wow.
I can't quite remember. But there were, I think there might have been a handful of distributors as well. There were some distilleries and stuff as well. But it was just such a phenomenal change from where we had been. It was unreal. It had gone from kind of this niche little thing that it felt like a few people were interested in, that was kind of gaining momentum, to like full on proper legitimate almost.
Where did that come from? Like, where did that growth come from? Because that's crazy growth when you think about it.
I think people just started appreciating, again, I think that appreciation for local, that appreciation for something that you could have a bit of a connection to. More people interested in getting into it as well meant that more people were talking about beer and more brands were popping up. So it was more likely that maybe people had heard of something local. I think we just got in at the beginning of a massive ramp up. So it was really incredible to see it. It's phenomenal. And I think even now there's like, there are still breweries in Ireland I've never heard of. I try and keep up with what's going on. It's a bit harder at the moment, but it's just mental.
So bring me up to current day, bring me up to like maybe just before COVID, what's been happening, which is in the last kind of year or two. We'll treat COVID separately. We'll deal with that quickly in a few minutes. The year before COVID and after COVID.
We opened a bar in 2017. One of the things that Tim and I had always felt was really part of what we wanted, because it was something that we always thoroughly enjoyed, was the whole brew pub aspect of things. And, you know, we wanted to have that place where people could come and sit and drink a good beer and talk to the people behind the bar about what kind of beer it was and what have you.
Was this part of the distillery or was this part of the brewery or was this separate?
So, well, that was it. And we where the brewery is at the moment, we knew we weren't going to be in a position to do that where we were. And we weren't going to be able to move for a while for various different reasons because there was, well, there was going to be a project to move, but it was getting, it had gotten pushed out twice. And we were like, look, if we're going to do this bar, maybe we should just have a look at doing it locally. And we dipped our toe into that and we looked at, you know, premises on and off for, we'd say, a couple of years. And then in, I would say October, maybe 2011, I got a call, or not 2011, 2017, I got a call from a friend of mine that said, this bar is coming up for rent. I think this is something you would be interested in. So we went and we had a look and it was a small bar. We thought we could probably make it work. No food, which would make it simple. Or rather, not that is completely not the word I should have used there, which would make it less complicated.
More straightforward.
Less complicated. To run, and we sort of took a bit of a fit and said, look, we've been talking about this for long enough. We've had the numbers mopped out. We plugged in the various ones for this project and we were just like, let's do it. Because at that time, what we felt was we were spending money on marketing and we really felt we didn't understand what sort of what we were getting back out of the marketing spend we were doing.
Okay, that's interesting.
And we thought, what about giving ourselves a platform? Because what we felt at the time as well was happening was that it was getting harder and harder to get taps in bars, and it was becoming more taps were rotating a lot more. So it was harder to get a permanent line. So you were constantly out trying to get beer into places, but then you might only maybe get 3 kegs and then you're back to the drawing board.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that they'd rotate them that quickly. I thought once you're in, you're in.
No.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there can be different incentives given as well, you see, to...
I gotcha.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
So, so we decided we would just go bananas and give this a lash and open a bar. And we tried it and I think we realized, like, it was a lot of fun, but we really realized after, I would say, 6 months, that probably the end of the first summer that we ran it, that it was just like we needed to have a person, and we had been looking for a manager all along, but we needed to get a person in that was going to be the person that would take over the day to day and the managing of it with the same vision, I suppose, that we wanted to have in there, that we wanted to have in there ourselves from ourselves, because what had been happening was I was spending a lot of time down there, but that was taking me out of the brewery. So that wasn't good either. And I really enjoyed being there, but I'm flighty and I'm a bit of an ideas person. So the type of work that's required in the discipline involved in running a bar day to day, I'm really not good at that sort of stuff. So that's really where I need a rock solid resource to be able to stay motivated and do all that stuff really well. I'm not good at that at all. I'm really shiny new thing type of person.
Standard entrepreneur, yeah.
So without that person there, we had a couple of near hires and then not quite making it. So I was still doing that and not doing it very well, I would put my hand up and say. And, you know, Tim was doing my job at the brewery, which he didn't like doing either. We really kind of found ourselves in a position where we're like, we're doing all of this work and we have this bar, but do we actually like having a bar in the first place? And it turned out we didn't. We like going to bars, but we didn't really like having a bar.
Yeah. It's a whole other business. Like it's, I know they're complimentary, but it's a whole other business. Like
100%, yeah. 100%. So we kind of just sat down and we were like, no, look, you know, if we get the right person in, that'll change our perspective on it. You know, that's what we would do. And we kept plugging away at trying to find the right person. We just, either we were looking in the wrong places or our expectations were completely unrealistic or the person that we were looking for just doesn't exist. And we just made the decision then with January and February were very hard. Then after Christmas, it's a, you know, like, and we're looking at it going, okay, let's look at the financials on this. If we don't have someone again, what's this going to mean for us on an individual level? It basically means a 7-day work week.
Yeah.
And it means, and what's it going to mean for the brewery? Mm. So we were just like, no, there's just no, this isn't viable in the format that it's in. And we're just going to, we just need to cut our losses now and say, look, this was an experiment. We tried it, but it's not where we want to be at this point. Mm. So I wouldn't rule out doing it again. But if we did it again, there would need to be somebody involved with the pub management side of it who wants to be in that position on the day-to-day face of it with Metal Man in support. And then between us, we can probably deliver a really good product. But as it was, we didn't really feel we had a good offering, and we weren't doing it very well. Mm. We weren't executing on it properly.
I'd imagine the lessons you learned, though, will stand you so well massive. In terms of if you're ever in the future. Massive. And you also know from the bar point of view as well what you're looking for now. So I'd imagine it was a very costly, personally, I'd say, experiment, but a great one all the same. I'd say you learned so many insights. Yeah.
And I love being behind the bar.
Fulfilling that fantasy of like, yeah.
I love it. And that's the bit that I really enjoy, but you can't, it's very, very hard to then be strategic.
Yeah, you've two jobs. You've just given yourself a second job.
In the bar is behind the bar. Mm. Yeah. So when I wasn't behind the bar, I needed to be strategic about the brewery, which just meant a voyage where the bar direction should have been. So
when you close that down, you refocus then on Metal Man. So what were your goals before COVID? Like what were you guys ramping towards, or what were you gearing up for?
We were trying to organize the distribution piece and get that sorted. We had a distribution arrangement lined up that was supposed to kick in 2019. And then that all fell through. So that left us with a gap where we needed to go back, refocus, and try and get that organized in terms of finding a new distributor for that piece that was now broken. So we spent a good chunk of 2019 doing that. We had just started work on we were producing a specific beer for a distributor in France. So we kicked that off at the beginning of 2019. So that was kind of fun. It's a style that we wouldn't normally have been brewing ourselves. We were making a Belgian double for them. So that's been going, that went quite well in 2019. Less so 2020, since all the bars are closed. I think Paris is closed again for 2 weeks. So that's not as fun. But again, really our plans for 2019 were just try and chip away at growth, the export side of things particularly, and then try and get the national distribution piece in place. So we started that with this year with Carlo, the Carlo distribution company called Radical Drinks. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's sort of where we are. We were just about to start our hiring plan for 2020 in March. And and then I decided not to.
Yeah, good. Probably a good choice. So bring me up to speed then quickly in terms of COVID. We'll just cover all that in terms of what's been happening. What impact has that had on a brewery? Because I know people look at pubs and go, oh, pub's closed. Very obvious, you know, it's closed. But people actually don't, unless they're involved in the industry, they don't see the trickle-down effect of goes back to the distributor, goes back to the brewery, goes back to the supplier. So what's it meant for you?
So I would say there's a little bit of there's opportunity. There's a decrease in our customer base, obviously, because a bunch of them are mandatory closed. There is opportunity then on the retail side for trying to support the, I suppose, increase in demand for shelf product. So we only can our beer. We don't have any bottles. So we have been, I suppose, trying to grow the availability of our canned products outside where we kind of started back in March. So that's been going quite well. What we've seen a real increase in the popularity of online sales for beer. Now, we're not allowed to sell directly ourselves. Our licensing are rather 3 cases of beer at a time, which is a bit of an investment for someone if they want to shop. But online retailers in general have seen a huge surge in demand for what it is they're doing.
So you're not able to sell, you know, an individual 12-pack or 6-pack, no?
No, and manufacturer's license for a brewery does not come with an automatic retail license. So
that seems odd.
If it was cheese, I could sell it, but because it's beer, I can't.
That's mad. Yeah. That's a strange little quirk.
No. I can sell you a 72-pack, but I can't sell you.
So, but you've seen that kind of grow since lockdown.
Yeah, for sure. So the there's more competition in the online craft beer retail space, which is good for consumers. You know, it's nice to have an options out there for people.
Was your beer sold mainly in pubs or mainly in shops and off licenses?
We were mostly draft. We had about 65% draft.
Okay.
To 35% cans. Yeah.
So the draft just switched off overnight, did it?
Yeah, pretty much. Restaurants and pubs that serve food started opening again at the end of June. So that opened up new options for us, particularly in the in parts of the southeast where there would have been a good tourism offering. People with a lot of outdoor space. The weather was good this summer, so there were a lot of there was good demand for places like Dunmore East and Intramore here, which, you know, they saw a good uplift once as long as they had a decent outdoor space and a good food offering. Then that really worked. But for the most part, then, like, I mean, it was still quite suppressed in terms of the number of our customers that were back. So then we got to a stage where some of them opened for a fortnight and then got closed down again. So it's tough.
What are you guys looking at now for kind of living with COVID or for your next, what are you thinking? How do you plan as a business like that? I think that's what people are all struggling with now.
It's really hard. I mean, I suppose we've taken our like 3-year plan and just turned it into a 4-year plan that starts in a year's time.
Okay.
And we've done, it's purely tactical. We're responding and trying to keep up with the developments as they happen and then plan for 6 months around that. So it's kind of a rolling 6 month to get us through and then to get us point to where we can implement our strategic plan. But I don't know if that's the right thing.
It's an interesting one, just to add on a year and shelf it. That's an interesting plan because everyone's doing different things. I think just trying to have some sort of plan is the key thing for people. And then let's imagine a post-COVID world for Metalman. What's kind of the future hold for you guys?
Hopefully there will be a post-COVID world for all of us.
That is green tea you're drinking, right?
It is green tea. Hopefully COVID will go away or be manageable. It's just really to continue chipping away and growing. Like, we don't have any plans for world domination or anything along those lines. We just want to keep making good beer.
Simple plans are always the best.
That's it. It's really boring, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really boring. Yeah. there were times when we played with this whole idea of, you know, massive growth and, oh, what if we do this and look at the other big craft breweries that are gone from blah here to there and then they end up getting acquired. And you're kind of like, yeah, it's a lot of work though. the older I get, the tireder I am.
At least you're honest as well. It's generally people who have the simple plans who end up are the most cunning. They're the ones that just, they really know what's going on behind it all. They secretly know. I have two final questions for you.
Yeah.
What is there any kind of book that's kind of made an impact on you, either personally or professionally?
I guess I read the from a professional point of view, I read Sam Calagione's Brewing Up a Business years ago when I first sort of started dabbling in the idea around this. And that was quite inspirational because that was, you know, the founder of a very cool brewery talking about his I suppose the challenges that he overcame and how he got started. And it was pretty different to where we were going to be going, obviously, But it was fun, and there's very little, there's very little new under the sun in a lot of ways. And it doesn't really matter whether your business is brewing or making cupcakes or developing an app. We all face pretty much exactly the same problems that need to get solved. So it's, you know, it's just like different flavors of the same Kool-Aid.
It's very true. They're all the same. They're all the same. That's why I love talking to so many different entrepreneurs across so many different industries, because the themes are generally the same. You'll find like, you know, it's variations on the same theme. You know, sales is tough, staff is tough, you know, it's variations. Yeah. So where can people learn a little bit more about Metalman and maybe order 72 cans?
72 cans. Well, we don't even try and go down that route, really. We would recommend you try someone like beercloud.ie or radicaldrinks.ie.
Beercloud.ie
or radicaldrinks.ie. Or
I'll link both of those. I'm over the second one, Radical.
Perfect. Yeah, Radical Drinks.
Radical Drinks. And where can people learn a little bit more then about Metalman?
They can go to our website, metalmanbrewing.com, which is now means that I have to go and update it because it's a little bit neglected. Because, you know, COVID, you can get away with a much.
You can get away with it, covers everything. I lied to you. I have one final question. And it's actually first thought I had when we were chatting. Where did the name come from?
So there is a navigational aid on the coast down here in Tremor. It was put up in the 1800s after a really bad shipwreck because Waterford is a deep harbour, but right next to it is Tremor Bay. It's a really shallow, rocky harbour, and there have been shipwrecks there from days of yore, forever and ever. Really bad shipwreck in the 1800s, and a lot of women and children died in it. So they put up a monument, a navigational aid on the coastline after that. And it's three pillars. And on the top of one of them is the figure of a man. And he is just locally known as the Metal Man. So we were like, yeah, we love that.
That's a great story. What a way to finish.
Yeah, cool, isn't it?
I love it. Grainne, thank you so much.
Cheers, Gary.
And that was my chat with Grainne from Metalman Brewing. I hope you learned a lot. I definitely learned a huge amount about what it takes to run a brewery. If you enjoyed the podcast and you're enjoying any of the podcast episodes, do me one favor. We're on the mission to get to 100,000 downloads before the end of the year. I want you to share the pod, this episode or any others, with one other person. And hopefully we can get to that magical number before the end of 2020. I'll see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab.